Good evening. My name's Yvonne Sherwood and I teach Biblical Studies and Jewish Studies at the University of Glasgow in Scotland. My co-panelists this evening on the far left are John Caputo, David R. Cook Professor of Philosophy at Villanova University, and just on my left here, Kevin Hart, Professor of English Literature at, and I'm told to say not Notre Dame, but Notre Dame, or something along those lines. John Caputo will be known to many of us as the author and editor of, among many other things, Against Ethics, Deconstruction in a Nutshell, The Prayers and Tears of Jacques Derrida, On Religion, God, the Gift and Postmodernism, and The Religious. Kevin Hart does interdisciplinary overtime as a theologian, a literary critic, and a poet in his own right. He's the author of The Trespass of the Sign and The Dark Gaze, Maurice Blanchot and Friends, as well as books on Samuel Johnson, A.D. Hope, and collections of his own poetry, including Dark Angel and Flame Tree. It's my very great pleasure to introduce, in French, one would say, vous présenter, Jacques Derrida, who we're so very pleased to say is here, present with us, right before our very eyes and ears. There are numerous ways that I could introduce this man, who, as an academic signature, needs no introduction, but who, because of the persistence of certain caricatures that still stand in for reading, perhaps in some sense still does. I could present him, as it's customary to do on these occasions, in terms of his curriculum vitae. But then his work, as he once said of Emmanuel Levinas, is now so large that one can no longer glimpse its edges. I could introduce him, as is also conventional, in terms of his institutional affiliations, past and present, for example, at Yale, the Sorbonne, the École Normale Supérieure in Paris, the University of California at Irvine, and so on. But I wouldn't want to give you an impression of someone too much in love with institutions who hasn't asked searching questions about the university and what the university means and does. Perhaps I could introduce him, as he sometimes has himself in a slightly tongue-in-cheek ecce homo, as a little Arab Jew, a Murano of French Catholic culture, who grew up in a Christianized Judaism that spoke of circumcision as baptism and bar mitzvah as communion, or as someone who regularly watches those Sunday morning TV programs on religion. These things certainly wouldn't be irrelevant to our context here at the American Academy of Religion and the Society of Biblical Literature. Perhaps the best way to introduce him in this context, without appropriating him for it, is to simply reel off a litany of topics that reverberate in his work as regularly as they reverberate around the discussions at our annual meetings. For example, Augustine, confession, circumcision, Paul, prayer, the spirit in the letter, the Talmud, the Talit, the touch of Jesus, the flood, the Tower of Babel, the sacrifice of Isaac and or Ishmael, Kierkegaard, messianism, wars of interpretation, Jerusalem, Kabbalah, religious violence, the limits of ecumenism and tolerance, sacrifice, the sacrifice of woman at the heart of sacrifice, ethics, responsibility and forgiveness, the eschaton, the apocalypse of John, the name of God. Perhaps I should just say, just once more, for the record, that Derrida is not an enemy of the good old Aufklärung, not an inventor of a machine or school called deconstruction or deconstructionism, not someone who believes that all the world's a text and we are merely players. Indeed, as Derrida has said, one of the requirements of deconstruction is that it touch on firm structures and physical institutions, that it make text answer precisely to what matters to us. A while ago, some of us got together to set an empty chair for Jacques Derrida at the annual meeting because we wanted to acknowledge the debt that many of us here owe to his work and because we wanted to create an opening for something yet to come. We are so very glad that Jacques Derrida is here, that he's graciously agreed to speak in English, a language which is not his, and we would like to say, first of all, welcome.
Jacques, I would like to start, maybe the best place to start would be to talk about prayer. And in circumfession, you say that you're a man of prayers and tears and that you pray all the time. And in the remark that you make to, that you direct to Jeffrey Bennington, you say, I wonder if I ought to tell them that I pray, and describe how that could happen, according to what idiom and what rite, on one's knees or standing up, in front of whom or what books. For if you knew, G, my experience of prayers, you would know everything. Now, what do you mean by that? To whom are you praying, and how would your prayers be answered if as you say elsewhere in that text, you rightly pass for an atheist? Who do you expect to answer the prayers?
In the sentence that you quote, the signatory of this text says, "J, if you knew my experience of prayers, you would know everything." So I understand you want to know everything. first, before I start trying to answer Jack's question, I would like to begin with a prayer, in fact. Mercy, I wanted to thank you, to all of you, for this extraordinary hospitality, to thank Yvonne, first of all. Your hospitality here is absolutely formidable, which means it's terrible for me. because on the one hand, as Yvonne emphasized, I'm improvising here in a foreign language, facing questions and problems in which everyone knows I'm not competent. And so I feel really, I'm very anxious, and this is not a fiction. I'm very anxious, and I'll try to do my best. The first time this invitation was extended to me was in Paris, where I met Yvonne. And at the time, it was a conference on, how would I call it, on Judaism or Jewishness, or my relation to Judaïté, as it's in French, Jewishness, in the plural, Jewishnesses, if I can translate the title of this conference. And I was already anxious. It was in a building belonging to the Jewish community in Paris. And I was terrified because, on the one hand, I knew that some of these people, at least, would try and denounce me for not being Jewish enough or authentically Jewish. Others would try to convert me to Judaism. And so it was a very strange moment. But I said yes to Yvonne. I tried. I was not expecting such an event. So, because I was not presenting myself in Paris as an authentic Jew, nor as a non-Jew. I'm not an expert in Judaism. And here, I'm not a Christian either, not a Muslim, not a Buddhist. I'm not a biblical scholar. I'm not a theologian. And I have to face the terrible questions which come from, first of all, very, very generous friends who surround me, but who are experts in these fields. So please forgive me, and that's my first prayer. I beg your pardon for what I'll try to, in a very shy way, to say in front of you and in front of my friends. Now I'll try to answer Jack's question. My first answer would be take the form of a question. To whom does one ask publicly, to say something about prayer, about the way he prays, before whom, and so on and so forth? If I were a priest or a theologian or a well-known believer, Jack wouldn't ask me such a question. If I were simply a non-believer, well-known as an atheist or as someone who is totally foreign to prayer, he wouldn't ask me this question. So why am I asked this question? Publicly. Some years ago, I would decline. I would say, no, I won't answer this question. And I'm wondering why I'm ready to say something. Before saying something in a very ingenuous, very, very naive and disarmed fashion, I would like to raise another question. In the text that you know better than others, and even better than me, in the text that you quote, you assume that I am the man who signed this text. The man who says, if I ought to tell them that I pray, and so on. But you know that the status of this text remains suspended. I'm not simply signing this text. This text has a structure. It's not a confession. It's a circumfession. So it's a text which turns around a possible, impossible confession. Only around circumcision, but around confession. So I'm not confessing. I'm not signing a confession. I'm not speaking in my own name, on the one hand. And on the other hand, this text is intertwined with quotes from St. Augustine. It's a very complex structure in which it's difficult even for me to decide who he's saying something about his prayer, his way of praying, and so on and so forth. So if I now answer your question, it would have nothing to do with the quote, because the quote is that if we had time, we would devote a long seminar on the status of this text, which is not theological, not a confession, not a letter, not... then I'll try to say something, nevertheless. Although, as you know, a prayer is something, at least for me, to the extent that I pray, if I pray, secret. It's absolutely secret. That is, of course, there are public prayers. There are people who in communities pray together. And the first thing I would tell you is that when I was young, my first rebellion against my own religious environment had to do with public prayer. Common, prayers in common. So my way of praying, if I pray, is absolutely secret. Even if I'm in a public, even if in a synagogue I was praying with others, I knew that my own prayer would be silent and secret and interrupting something in the community. So that's one more reason for not answering your question. Nevertheless, I'll say something. A prayer, on the one hand, has to be, the way I understand it, a mixture of something absolutely singular and secret, that is idiomatic, untranslatable, and at the same time, a ritual, that is involving the body in coded gestures, in common language, in an intelligible language. So there's this mixture of between a secret and sacred idiom and some common ritual in which the body accepts to make coded gestures. That's the way, if I pray, that I pray. That is something absolutely idiomatic and something which looks like what many people in many cultures, many religions do. Sometimes kneeling, sometimes with a book, sometimes without book or kneeling, sometimes walking, sometimes. I pray all the time. If I pray all the time, even now. But we have a problem. I have to address each question for 10 minutes. Okay, so, because there are a number of questions coming. I would say, second, that my way of praying, if there is such a thing, if I pray, has more than one age in the same instant. There is something very childish. And when one prays, one is always a child. Something childish, something archaic. Gathering some memories of my childhood, and the images, the imagery, the iconography of God as a grandfather, a severe, just grandfather with a beard. And at the same time, a mother who thinks I am innocent, that is ready to forgive me. Okay? So there are these naive couple, naive image of a couple of a terribly just but merciless father, but just, understanding father, and a mother who is trying to trust my innocence. This is the layer of the childish layer of my prayers. The ones I perform once a day, for instance, before going to bed, or I pray a little time right now. Now there is also mixed with this on this layer, there's another layer, of course, which involves my culture, my philosophical, critical experience, my experience of apophasis, my experience of a critic of religion, going through Feuerbach to Nietzsche to all of these things, the experience of a non-believer, someone who is constantly suspicious of the child, okay? And who resists, and who says, well, whom am I praying? Whom am I addressing? Who is God, and so on and so forth. And in this layer of sophistication, if I may call this this way, I find a way of, let's say, meditating about who is praying and the who is receiving the prayer, the who my address. And I know that this very apparently negative. It's not negative, it's just a way of thinking. I think. When I pray, I think. I try to think. And this thinking prayer is not simply negative. It's a way of asking all the questions that we are asking here in this conference. A lot of them, of course. I cannot summarize these questions in two minutes now. But these questions are part of my experience of prayer. When I pray, I'm just thinking about negative theology, about the unnameable, the possibility for me to be totally deceived by my belief, and so on and so forth. It's a very skeptical, I don't like this word, but this can be interpreted as a very skeptical prayer. Very skeptical. And this skepticism is part of the prayer. Instead of skepticism, I would call the epoche, the suspension of belief, the suspension of certainty, not of belief, the suspension of certainty is part of the prayer. And then I consider that this suspension of the certainty, the suspension of knowledge, this inability to answer your question, to whom? Who do you expect to answer these prayers? Is part of what a prayer has to be in order to be authentic. If I knew, if I were simply expecting an answer, that would be the end of a prayer. That would be an order, the way I order a pizza. Okay? No, I'm not expecting. And my assumption is that I must give up any expectation, any certainty as to the one or more than one to whom I address this prayer, if this is still a prayer. And, of course, the child is praying for expecting some answer or expecting some protection for himself, for life, for his beloved ones, for his relatives, for wife, children, friends, and so on and so forth. But I can't tell if I'm praying someone, invisible, transcendent one, or if I'm praying precisely these other ones in myself that I want to address out of love and for the protection of their lives. Now, I'm already too long. Now, there is at the same time some suspension of any expectation, of any economy, any calculation. I'm not expecting, I'm not hoping. It's a hopeless prayer, on the one hand. Totally, totally hopeless. And I think this hopelessness is part of what a prayer should be. And on the other hand, I know there is hope, there is calculation, there is economy. But what sort of economy? Is it the economy of the child or my own economy as an old man? By the way, if I accept to answer to some extent Jack's question, something I wouldn't have done some years ago, it's probably because growing old, I am more of a child than when I was younger. So I say, well, now perhaps I might run the risk of saying something confidential in front of such an audience. So the calculation, if there is a calculation, and obviously there is a calculation, despite the uncalculable hopelessness that I mentioned earlier, there is a calculation. That calculation, if I wanted to describe it briefly, would take the following form. I know that praying in that way, even if there is no one God in the form of a father or mother or receiving my prayer, I know that by this act of praying in the desert, out of love, because I wouldn't pray otherwise, something might be already good in myself, like a therapy in some way. I know that by doing this, I try, not necessarily succeed, but I try to affirm and to accept something in myself, which won't do any harm to anyone, especially to me. The impression that I do something good to myself, that's the calculation, and by the same token, to my beloved ones. If through this prayer I am a little better and reconciled, and if I give up any calculation because of this calculation about around the incalculable, I can become better for myself, narcissistically, but to become better narcissistically is a way of loving in a better way, or being more lovable for our beloved ones. So that's a calculation. It's a calculation which tries to integrate the incalculable. And this, when I pray, it's a mixture of all these in the same instant, the same words or same gestures. I experience a sort of strange experience in which the Judaism of my childhood, my experience as a philosopher, as a quasi-theologian, all the texts I've read from Plato to St. Augustine to Heidegger to some, they constitute my world, the world in which my prayers praise, okay? And that's the way I pray, sometimes in a given and fixed moment in the day, sometimes anywhere, at any moment, for instance, now. I should stop.
I'd like to begin with a general question about the relations between deconstruction and Christianity. You've pointed out that deconstruction is not to be regarded as a set of theses that can be simply removed from the contexts in which you write and applied to other contexts. It has neither a thetic character nor a proper home. Rather, deconstruction exists in its applications. It's forever mobile, reformulating itself in quite different places and times. In your early work, you came to deconstruction by way of particular philosophical and literary contexts. But as you know, deconstruction also has a rich Judaic-Christian heritage. One could see Heidegger's destruction of metaphysics as a folding of Luther's Heidelberg disputation, which itself folds St. Paul's warning to the Corinthians, which has itself already folded Isaiah's vision of Yahweh's sentence, "I will destroy the wisdom of the wise." I'm not suggesting that deconstruction can be translated without remainder by Heidegger's destruction, or that destruction can be translated without remainder by Luther's Destruntur. Rather, I'm drawing attention to a Judaic-Christian heritage of deconstruction. If this heritage exists and has effects, wouldn't a deconstruction of Christianity be bound to meet an internal limit? I'm thinking of Jean-Luc Nancy's project, needless to say, but more generally of movements of deconstruction already in Christianity, beginning with the formation of the canon and the writings of the Church Fathers. What sort of negotiations do you see as significant in that encounter?
Thank you, Kevin. Well, the word negotiations is a very difficult one here, because this negotiation, if there is such a thing, it shouldn't be a compromise, to be a very a very risky movement. But of course, and I would totally agree with you, there is a Christian heritage, in Judeo-Christian heritage. And since you mentioned Jean-Luc Nancy's project, Jean-Luc Nancy, I know that not everyone in this room knows the context in which in France I've been working during the last years. Jean-Luc Nancy is one of my best friends who is currently in France, who is currently writing or trying to write what he calls a deconstruction, a book on deconstruction of Christianity. And already in the preface that he gave to this book, he agrees that Christianity is already self-deconstructed. So that the deconstruction of Christianity might be, in a certain way, the achievement of Christianity. And this could be true in many ways, not only because of the tradition that you recalled, Heidegger's Destruction, implying, without being reducible to it, implying Luther's project of Destructio, and so on and so forth, but also because, and of course, the way I try and practice deconstruction would be an attempt to, on the one hand, think, understand this tradition with its differences, its internal differences, and its breaks, because Heidegger cannot be reduced to Luther, and so on and so forth. But at the same time, while I try to understand and to assume and to accept, in a certain way, this tradition, I would try to do something else. That is, what I call deconstruction, I have a secret hope that it affects this tradition, not by betraying it, not by simply deforming it, but in a certain way affects this tradition in a unexpected, in a new way. Now, this other way, I could give you a number of signs of the fact that what I'm doing is not Heideggerian, as you know, it's not Lutheran either. But this doesn't mean, and I think I would agree with you on that point, this doesn't mean that it's totally foreign to Jewish, Christian, or even Islamic possibility. Now, if this type of deconstruction that I try remains, let's say, Abrahamic, Jewish, Christian, Islamic, or whatever else, this would imply that it's part of this tradition, it's the memory of this tradition, but also that it affects this tradition in a way which is unpredictable. That is, what is Christianity and what is Judaism? Who knows? Who knows what it will be in the future? Okay? So, if assuming that the new Christians or the new Jews or the new Muslims, assuming that they will have practiced this unpredictable new form of deconstruction, what are the criteria to say, well, this new form is Christian, I recognize it as Christian? My assumption is that Christianity, since here Christianity is more present, I understand, that other religions, but and the fact that the word deconstruction, that's why I think we should relate more to Christianity than to Judaism and Islam, because the word deconstruction, referring to Heidegger, Destruction, and to Luther, Destruontur, is more linked to Christianity than to Judaism and Islam. I mean, literally. But the fact that it is linked literally to Christianity doesn't mean that it is more, that Christianity is more deconstructive than other religions. Because I can imagine Jewish theologians or Muslim theologians or Buddhist, I have this experience, people coming from Far Eastern cultures tell me, well, deconstruction, we know that. We've known that for centuries. We've done nothing new. And I'm sure that there are Jewish theologians and Talmudists and probably Muslim theologians who would say the same. But the fact that the link to Christianity is more obvious, more apparent, more literal than the link to other religions doesn't mean that Christianity has more affinity with deconstruction than any other culture or religion. Now, if what remains for me, at least, and especially in what is currently happening in the world, what Christianity will become in the coming centuries is totally unpredictable. And perhaps it's the religion, if I can use this word, which is more prepared, more apt to transform itself than any other. When I spoke of mondial latinisation, that is the globalization as a Christianization, as a Roman Christianization, I implied that Christianity is the most plastic, the most open religion, that is the most prepared, better prepared to unpredictable transformations. That is, at the same time, the strongest and the more flexible to the event, to what is coming, to a new unpredictable form. So perhaps, in that case, if the Christian deconstruction develops, one day, at the same time, we won't recognize the Christian roots of Christian religion, and nevertheless be able to say, well, it is still Christian. And I think that what is happening today, and especially in places like this, is at least the obscure feeling that something is happening to Christianity, which is an unpredictable earthquake. Not necessarily a negative one, but unpredictable earthquake.
I've got a question for Reb Reeder, as you've called yourself. Although you've never invoked the Jewish tradition in any rooted or direct way, I think there are many resonances between your work and the Midrashim. For example, when you ask in the Gift of Death whether the story of the sacrifice of Isaac is predicated on the sacrifice of woman in both active and passive senses, woman as object and subject of sacrifice, I think of the ancient Midrashim that see the death of Sarah in Genesis 23 as a consequence of Genesis 22. I'm interested to hear how you might read a couple of Midrashic fragments from Genesis Rabbah, which treat, as you do, subjects of blood, sacrifice, love, circumcision, and woman, and that in fact seem to read the sacrifice of Isaac as a hyper-circumcision. The first fragment is a commentary on God's rather overqualified command to Abraham, take your son, your only son, whom you love, even Isaac. And it goes like this. God said, take your son. Abraham said to him, I have two sons. He said to him, "Your only one." He said, "This one is the only son to his mother, and this one is the only one to his mother." He said to him, "Whom you love?" He said, "I love them both." He said to him, "Isaac." And the second fragment stages a drama that precedes the sacrifice, and it goes like this. Isaac and Ishmael were engaged in controversy. The latter argued, "I'm more beloved than you because I was circumcised at the age of 13. While the other retorted, "I'm more beloved than you because I was circumcised at 8 days. Ishmael said to him, "I'm more beloved than you since I was circumcised at 13 and could have protested, but you were circumcised as a baby and could not refuse." At that moment, Isaac exclaimed, "Oh, that God would appear to me and bid me cut off my limbs, then I would not refuse." Another version says, Isaac retorted, "All that you did was lend to the Holy One, blessed be he, 3 drops of blood. But I'm now 37 years old, yet if God desired of me that I be slaughtered, I would not refuse."
Thank you. Perhaps at the end of my two answers, I'll try to relate the two commentaries. The first one, I would say, that's I improvise an hypothesis. The first one tells us about the terrible experience of, let's say, facing God, obeying God, who gives unjustifiable orders in the name of love, the one you love. And asks someone, in this case Abraham, to choose between two equally beloved sons. Abraham says, "I love them equally. Both are the sons of their mother, of his mother, and I love them equally." And God insists, you're only one. So you have to elect one. So then Abraham insists, "I love both." And he said, "I love them both." And God said, "Isaac, just one." It's a terrible, terrible situation. Long before the experience of the what one calls sacrifice, not a sacrifice, but even before going up to the Mount Moriah. It's terrible when we have to choose between two equally beloved ones. That's a terrible experience we experience every day. So what Abraham experiences at that moment is that he has to blindly obey an order, an heteronomic order, for which no justification can be provided. No intelligible justification. Okay? So immediately this situation goes beyond, let's say, any ethical, any human level. It's not. That's what Kierkegaard says. In fact, Abraham remains a criminal on the level of ethics. It's a crime. And when Abraham accepts that God, in a way which is totally asymmetrical, says, "Well, I elect you in order that you elect one of your sons, and you elect him as the one who you love. I suppose you love him more than the other, in order to kill him." So here we have the experience of this terrible law of the duty, that is to act out of duty to act while obeying God. You must give up any justification, any human intelligible justification. You have to give up any knowledge. So the leap, what one calls the leap of Abraham, is a leap beyond knowledge, beyond ethics, beyond social bonds, beyond love. Beyond love, out of love, because God says, the one you love. So that's the absolute religious experience, if there is such a thing. The pure act of faith, the asymmetrical obedience to an absurd order, an unintelligible order, beyond ethics, knowledge, and so on and so forth. Now, the second commentary has to do with two ways of understanding circumcision. On the one hand, Isaac, who has been circumcised before having to accept circumcision, before having to understand. That's what happens in Jewish religion. So 7 days, that is, it's a covenant which is signed and to which one has to subscribe before understanding anything, before opening one's eyes, before speaking. So on, as opposed to this, the Ishmael in Muslim culture said, well, at least I was old enough to understand, that is, to transform the heteronomy into an autonomy. I was freely accepting circumcision. So my faith is more intelligible, more authentic than yours, because in a certain way I was autonomous, more autonomous than you were.